From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Talking about tens of thousands of people who are left behind, and those are the sickest, the oldest, poorest, the youngest, the people with disabilities and the like, and the plan was that everybody should leave. Well, you can't leave if you're in a hospital. You can't leave if you're a nurse. You can't leave if you're a patient. You can't leave if you're in a nursing home. You can't leave if you don't have a car.
Two years ago, Hurricane Katrina hit. The levees broke, as did New Orleans. Today, we look at the path of destruction, the devastation of New Orleans, and the coming age of superstorms. Then the second part of our conversation with acclaimed psychologist author Mary Pfeiffer. She returned her award to the APA, protesting psychologists' involvement in interrogations.
I felt like, especially in view of what I was given the award for, I needed to be a compassionate guider of our field at this moment in time.
And last-minute appeals in the case of death row prisoner Kenneth Foster. He's scheduled to be executed by the state of Texas tomorrow. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration is preparing to ask Congress for an additional $50 billion for war in Iraq. The request would come on top of a $460 billion defense budget and nearly $150 billion in supplemental war funding. Administration officials are said to be confident lawmakers won't oppose the request once Army General David Petraeus issues his long-awaited progress report on Iraq. The news comes one day after the Washington Post reported Petraeus softened intelligence findings on Iraq's progress in advance of his congressional appearance. Meanwhile, the Bush administration continues its campaign against Iran. On Tuesday, President Bush threatened to confront Iran for what he said was its backing of attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq.
They cannot escape responsibility for aiding attacks against coalition forces and the murder of innocent Iraqis. The Iranian regime must halt these actions. And until it does, I will take actions necessary to protect our troops. I have authorized our military commanders in Iraq to confront Tehran's murderous activities.
Bush's comments came as U.S. troops arrested seven Iranian nationals in Baghdad. They were released hours later. In other Iraq news, more than 1 million pilgrims have been ordered to flee the Shiite holy city of Karbala. Gun battles between rival Shiite groups have killed dozens and wounded hundreds more. Meanwhile, the Iraqi refugee crisis worsens by the month. The United Nations says the monthly rate of displacement has reached 60,000 people, an increase of 10,000 over previous estimates. Some 4.2 million Iraqis have fled their homes since the U.S. invasion of Iraq. A military jury has exonerated the only officer facing trial for abusing detainees at Abu Ghraib. On Tuesday, Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Jordan was cleared of allegations he personally abused prisoners and trained other soldiers convicted of mistreatment. The verdict means no other officer will serve prison time over the Abu Ghraib scandal. In Afghanistan, Taliban militants have released eight South Korean hostages, the first under a deal with the South Korean government to free all 19 surviving captives. South Korea government spokesperson Chun Ho-seon announced the agreement.
The Taliban agreed to the release after South Korea agreed to meet certain conditions, such as halting its citizens from conducting Christian missionary activity in Afghanistan and withdrawing South Korean troops dispatched to Afghanistan.
23 South Koreans were initially taken hostage. Two male hostages were killed, while two females were later set free. In Israel and the occupied territories, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert met in Jerusalem Tuesday in advance of a proposed peace conference for later this fall. Abbas has come under criticism from rival Palestinian faction Hamas for isolating Hamas and failing to win firm guarantees for an end to the Israeli stronghold over the West Bank and Gaza. This is Hamas spokesperson Sami Abu Zuhri.
Such meetings will never achieve anything as long as the Israeli occupation continues to deny the rights of our people and continues their aggression against our people. And the only party benefiting from these meetings is the Israeli occupation that shines its image in front of the world.
Israel has yet to act on a pledge to ease some of the 450 roadblocks and checkpoints across the occupied territories. Earlier this week, an ailing one-year-old Palestinian boy died while waiting several hours at the Eretz crossing into Israel. The child, Ibrahim Abu Nahel, was being taken by his father for treatment for a heart condition. They were forced to wait despite holding a medical permit. In Russia, the defense lawyer for one of the 10 suspects held in the killing of the journalist Anna Politkovskaya is claiming his client was abused in police custody. Murad Musayev says his client was assaulted while divided from other suspects.
They're residents of Moscow. It was totally unexpected for them, and they are in shock. They still don't understand why it happened, and now they're in detention.
Politkovskaya was shot dead outside her home last October. She was a fierce critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin in the Chechen War. Prosecutors say a Chechen crime boss and Russian police were all involved in her killing. In Chile, the former head of the Chilean secret police has been sentenced to life in prison. Retired General Hugo Salas Wenzel was found guilty of ordering the 1987 Corpus Christi massacre that killed 12 rebels. Salas Wenzel is the first Chilean general given a life sentence for human rights abuses under the late dictator Augusto Pinochet. In Mexico, dozens of black-clad women marched through Mexico City Tuesday to mark the 29th anniversary of the Mexican human rights group Eureka. The marchers commemorated the anniversary of a 100-day hunger strike that led to probes into political murders and the release of political prisoners. This is Mexican Senator and Eureka founder Rosario Ibarra.
Freedom to political prisoners, freedom to the disappeared, an end to torture and punishment to those guilty. That is all, and it's not vengeance, it's justice. The law should be respected. That is what we want.
Back in the United States, new census figures show the number of Americans without health insurance has reached a record 47 million. The figure marks an increase of 2.2 million people over the previous year. Middle and high-income families accounted for much of the newly uninsured. 1 million newly uninsured worked full-time. 1.4 million had a household income of at least $75,000. The number of uninsured children also rose by 600,000, the second straight year it's increased. 11% of Americans under 18 years old are without coverage. Meanwhile, the poverty rate showed a slight decline. The drop was attributed to more people working per household for longer hours rather than an increase in wages. Here in New York, a new study shows Ground Zero rescue and recovery workers have developed asthma at 12 times the normal rate. According to the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, more than 926,000 workers reported developing asthma after working at Ground Zero. The normal number for a group that size would be 77 people. A new study shows the United States is the most heavily armed society in the world. According to the Graduate Institute of International Studies Small Arms Survey, there are 90 guns for every 100 Americans. U.S. citizens account for nearly one-third of an estimated 875 million firearms worldwide. More than half of guns manufactured each year are purchased in the United States. And Republican Senator Larry Craig of Idaho is facing a potential ethics probe following his admission to pleading guilty to disorderly conduct this past June. Police say Craig was detained after he made sexual advances to an undercover officer in a men's bathroom in the Minneapolis airport. In his first public comments Tuesday, Craig repeatedly said that he isn't gay and claimed he pleaded guilty because of pressure from a newspaper investigation into other alleged sexual encounters he had in men's bathrooms.
Let me be clear. I am not gay. I never have been gay. Still, without a shred of truth or evidence to the contrary, the statesman has engaged in this witch hunt. In pleading guilty, I overreacted in Minneapolis because of the stress the Idaho Statesman investigation and the rumors it has fueled all around Idaho.
Senator Craig has voted against same-sex marriage and spoken out against homosexuals serving in the military. And this correction on the headlines, according to the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, more than 900 of 26,000 workers reported developing asthma after working at Ground Zero. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Today marks the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, The storm made landfall south of New Orleans at 6:10 a.m. on August 29, 2005. The powerful hurricane ravaged the Gulf Coast of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama and left over 1,600 people dead. More than 300,000 homes were destroyed and over 770,000 people displaced. It was the most powerful and expensive natural disaster to hit the country and one of the deadliest hurricanes in U.S. history. 80% of New Orleans was submerged underwater after the storm surge caused several breaches in the city's levees. In the aftermath of the hurricane, the federal government was nowhere to be found. Images of New Orleans residents piling into the Superdome and Convention Center pleading for food, water, and aid were broadcast around the world.
We go back now, 2 years ago, to remember some of Democracy Now!'s coverage of Hurricane Katrina. This is New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin.
Ladies and gentlemen, I wish I had better news for you, but we are facing a storm that most of us have feared. Every person is hereby ordered to immediately evacuate the city of New Orleans, or, if no other alternative is available, to immediately move to one of the facilities within the city that will be designated as a refuge of last resort.
And the Gulf Coast region remain in a state of catastrophe following the devastating Hurricane Katrina. At least 80% of New Orleans is underwater. The city has no electricity and little drinkable water. Officials say New Orleans will be uninhabitable for weeks. On Tuesday, two levees broke, flooding areas of the city that appeared to survive the storm.
This is a national disaster. Get every doggone Greyhound bus line in the country and get their asses moving to New Orleans. That's they thinking small, man, and this is a major, major, major deal.
Talking about tens of thousands of people who are left behind, and those are the sickest, the oldest, poorest, the youngest, the people with disabilities and the like, and the plan was that everybody should leave. Well, you can't leave if you're in a hospital. You can't leave if you're a nurse. You can't leave if you're a patient. You can't leave if you're in a nursing home. You can't leave if you don't have a car.
To commemorate the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, protesters plan to march today from the Lower Ninth Ward to Congo Square to spread their message that after 2 years, the government has failed to help people return to their city. The anniversary has attracted a slew of politicians to New Orleans, chief among them President Bush, who arrived in the city with Laura Bush Tuesday night. The president is scheduled to make a televised address there later today. Meanwhile, an international people's tribunal has been convened in New Orleans to take testimony from victims of the disaster. The tribunal is being spearheaded by legal activists trying to build a case under international law, accusing the U.S. government of human rights abuses during and after Katrina.
John McQuaid is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. In 2002, he co-authored a series in the New Orleans Times-Picayune, where he'd worked for more than 20 years. That predicted the fate that would befall New Orleans 3 years later. He's just published a three-part investigative series in Mother Jones magazine called Storm Warning, and he's co-author of the book Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. John McQuaid joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Good morning.
Can you talk about what you understood 3 years before Katrina hit, what it meant for what actually happened and what it means for today?
Well, it was common knowledge in the disaster management community that New Orleans was incredibly vulnerable to a large hurricane. And my co-author and I looked at that issue. We looked at the levee system and specifically weaknesses in the levee system. Was the Corps of Engineers really telling us the truth when it said we were well protected? We concluded that it was not. And in fact, it turned out that things were far worse than even we had anticipated, because there were actually flaws, engineering flaws, in the levee system that caused walls to collapse prematurely and flooded vast areas of the city that otherwise would not have flooded.
Now, you talk in your series of articles about what has happened since then, and the promise is to rebuild the protection for New Orleans from the federal government. What has happened?
Well, the Corps, after Katrina, the Corps pumped the water out of the city and then immediately turned around and started repairing the levees, designing fixes for where the holes were, and rebuilding. And over the last 2 years, they have repaired the levees, and they're now trying to upgrade the system so that it's there's a standard level of protection everywhere. Because before, it was depending on where you were, it was variable how much risk you faced. However, all of this is basically a giant stopgap. The level of protection that they're providing, which is a 1-in-100-year event protection, is really not strong enough. It wouldn't have protected against Katrina, for example. It's not strong enough to protect the city over the long run. And so the Corps is also studying how to do that. But right now, there is no master plan on how to do that. And it's going to be very costly. And frankly, I'm not sure that we have the resources and the institutional moxie in place to be able to do that.
And when you talk about, depending on where you were in New Orleans, the kind of protection you had, how does that correlate to the issues of race and class that were bared in the aftermath of the storm and the government's response?
It has more to do with geography, but also with race and class. Basically, areas in the eastern part of the city, including the lower Ninth Ward, which is predominantly African American, and St. Bernard Parish, which is predominantly white working class, as well as Eastern New Orleans, which is a kind of mixed but predominantly black middle class suburb, those areas were much more exposed to storm surges than areas to the west, which includes the center of New Orleans, which is mixed but it has a larger white and more upper class population. So the poorer and the African American populations did bear more of the risk pre-Katrina.
We're talking to John McQuaid, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who co-wrote the book Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. After Hurricane Katrina hit, you looked to places in the world that have a better system of dealing with hurricanes. You wrote a piece called, let's see if I can find it here, the piece you wrote about what the Dutch can teach us about weathering the next Katrina.
Yes, well, I visited the Netherlands a few months after Katrina to look at what the lessons were. And there were two primary lessons. One, of course, is technology. The Dutch really know how to evaluate the risk and how to build really high-tech structures that can close on the drop of a dime and are really good at protecting the city. There's a real strategy at work there, as opposed to New Orleans, where things were very haphazardly put together and to some extent still are. So the Dutch really know how to build a system. But the deeper lesson for America, I think, is more the political system. The fact that in the United States, hurricane protection is just not very politically popular in the same sense as pork is. Basically, hurricane protection, which obviously protects lives and property, got mixed in with all these other porkified projects in Congress. And there was no way, the way the system is set up, to sort out what's important and what's not. And so, as a result, the levees got shorted over a period of years and decades leading up to Katrina. And that's still the system we have in place. The Dutch, by contrast, decide, well, we want to protect against this type of storm or this level of risk, and you have to build to that level of protection or you're in violation of the law. And so they start with laying down that benchmark and they go from there. We don't have anything like that. And as a result, I think that put New Orleans at risk. And increasingly with climate change, I think you're going to see other coastal areas put at risk just as New Orleans is.
John McQuay, we're going to come back to this conversation. We also are headed to New Orleans and will be broadcasting from there Thursday and Friday. John McQuay is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, wrote for the Times-Picayune for more than 20 years. His book is called Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. Stay with us.
What has happened down here? Is the wind have changed? Clouds rolled in from the north and it started to rain. It rained real hard and it rained for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. The river rose all day, the river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. River had busted through, cleared out the plague of mine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana. Louisiana. They're trying to wash us away. Trying to wash us away. Oh, Louisiana. Louisiana. Trying to wash us away.
Aaron Neville, Louisiana, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting in over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 9410, Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our website also has our headlines in Spanish and audio and transcript form for any radio station to take around the world. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, the drowning of an American city, New Orleans. Our guest, John McQuay, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, wrote for the Times-Picayune for more than two decades, has written the book, co-authored with Mark Schleifstein, Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans, and the Coming Age of Superstorms, and has done a series for Mother Jones magazine on the lessons unlearned at this point. Juan?
John, before the break, we were talking about the situation in the Netherlands. That country responded after a huge hurricane in 1953, I think, that killed about 1,800 people. But you described the strategy that the Dutch used for protecting their population, which is very different from what the United States and what the Army Corps of Engineers is doing in New Orleans. And you talk about how they don't actually build their levees around the populated areas as much as they do in the estuaries and where the water would hit land in major storms. Can you talk about that?
Prior to the 1953 storm, populated areas in the south of the country, which is where most of the damage was, were ringed by dikes, or dikes are essentially levees. And so you had water coming far inland, just as it did in New Orleans, and breaking through dikes and flooding out vast areas. So after that, they decided, well, we need a shift in strategy. And so they looked at the geography and they said, well, the water is coming in through these three relatively narrow openings, so that if we build barriers at these openings, we will essentially not have to build these hundreds and hundreds of miles of dikes behind them. Because the more miles of dikes you have, the more places your system can fail. So they built these very large structures across these openings. and they had to deal with the ecology, because you can't just shut off an estuary and expect things to remain the same. So they created barriers that could open and close. And that has worked out quite well. Ecologically, there have been a lot of problems with that. But I think in terms of protecting the population, it's been a great success. Now, that technique can be applied to New Orleans. It's not a perfect fit, because New Orleans is basically surrounded by water, as opposed to the Netherlands, which has a coastline. But there are lots of areas in New Orleans where if you put a gate, a gated structure, you can protect pretty large areas behind it and not have to rely so much on levees, which, as we saw during Katrina, is a pretty risky strategy.
John McQuaid, you write about lessons unlearned. Last night, the mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, had dinner with President Bush. President Bush continues through the area today, a place he wasn't 2 years ago when the hurricane hit and the levees broke, and for the days afterwards. What are these lessons unlearned right now?
I, like many people, expected there to be an assessment after Katrina. Well, what went wrong in terms of both protecting the city pre-Katrina and in terms of the emergency response? But there really hasn't been that debate. Ordinarily, you expect some, and in the past, historically, there have been some of these giant reassessments where you rearrange the structure of government, you build new structures, new technologies are brought to bear. And that hasn't really happened in this situation. There's been a kind of drift in the national debate. There hasn't been a lot of focus from the White House on the issue. The main solution from the White House has been to throw money at the problem. And obviously, the problem does require money. But I think it requires leadership. And that's what we really haven't seen. Because structurally, I think you have to look at what went wrong. And obviously, the way things were set up before, both in terms of building levees and emergency response, the institutions were not set up right. They're still not set up right. It seems incredible to me that you can have the Corps of Engineers build a really terrible levee system, a flawed levee system, and then have them simply turn around and start building a new one as if nothing has happened. But that's essentially what's going on now.
And what about the two, I guess, institutions of government that took the most criticism, the Corps of Engineers and FEMA? Michael Brown, the poster child, I guess, for ineptitude in government, is now a disaster consultant of all things. But how do you see that FEMA and the Corps of Engineers have changed since then?
Well, there have been some improvements, but the central problems are still there. FEMA is still a relatively weak agency embedded in a giant, new, terribly disorganized department, the Homeland Security Department. And so I think everybody in FEMA and Homeland Security is now more vigilant when a storm strikes. But I don't think that they have the flexibility needed to command the resources immediately after a giant disaster, or over the long term to plan for how to do that. And so I think you need to provide more institutional support to rebuild the bureaucracies in these places, and B, put in people who know what they're doing and have the ear of the president. The Corps, it's sort of a similar situation. The Corps conducted a big investigation into the levee failures, but its own investigation didn't really examine what the Corps did wrong institutionally. It just said, well, we made these miscalculations here, or the mud was too soft here, et cetera. They did another study, or the Defense Department did a study looking at the history of decision making, but there hasn't really been serious self-reassessment. And I think that needs to come from the outside, from Congress or the president, in order to shake up the agency and say, well, what went wrong? Obviously, things are set up badly. The Corps is still a very pork-driven agency. What can we do to change the way this is set up? And it goes to the way these resources are allocated by the federal government.
It may surprise some that Michael Brown, who, well, famous for President Bush's comment, "You're doing a heck of a job, Brownie," is a disaster consultant today, splitting his time between Colorado and Washington, D.C. But perhaps more relevant is the head of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, being considered for Attorney General. In the last few seconds, John McQuaid, your thoughts on Chertoff's performance as head of Homeland Security, as head of FEMA, ultimately responsible after the hurricane?
Well, I thought Brown didn't know what he was doing, but at least he cared about emergency management. Chertoff, as he said afterward, "I'm not a hurricane operator." Chertoff did not really view it as his job at the time to oversee emergency response to a big disaster. He had no experience, and during the first several days of the storm, he was completely disengaged. During, I think, on the Thursday of that week, he was unaware that there were large numbers of people gathered at the convention center. He didn't even know where the convention center was in New Orleans. He was mixing it up with the Superdome. So I think he really fell down on the job, and that does not speak particularly well to his being Attorney General.
John McQuaid, thanks so much for being with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. His book is called Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans in the Coming Age of Superstorms, has now done a series of pieces for Mother Jones Magazine on the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Democracy Now! Heads to New Orleans today. We'll be broadcasting from there on Thursday and Friday. Juan?
Well, calls for Texas death row prisoner Kenneth Foster to be granted clemency are increasing. Former President Jimmy Carter and South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu have urged Texas to stop Thursday's scheduled execution. Foster's attorney has filed a last-minute appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Meanwhile, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles meets today to decide Kenneth Foster's fate. Foster is one of three death row prisoners set to die this week in Texas. Last night, the state executed DeRoyce Mosley. Tonight, John Joe Amador is scheduled to be killed. All three men are African-American or Latino. What makes Foster's case unique is that he's set to be executed for a murder that the state of Texas admits he didn't commit or plan.
11 years ago, Kenneth Foster was driving a car with three passengers. One of the passengers left the car, got into an altercation, and shot a man dead. The shooter was executed for this crime last year. At the time of the shooting, Kenneth Foster was 80 feet away in the car, but Foster was sentenced to die as well under what's known as the law of parties. The law imposes the death penalty on anyone involved in a crime where a murder occurred. To talk more about the case, Liliana Segura joins us here in New York. She's an activist with a campaign to end the death penalty and a freelance writer. Published in The Nation magazine and Alternate. Welcome to Democracy Now! In these few minutes, what is the state of Kenneth Foster's case right now, scheduled to die tomorrow night?
Well, basically, as you mentioned, the Board of Pardons and Paroles makes its recommendation today, I believe at 1 p.m., to Governor Rick Perry. And actually, that recommendation was supposed to be made yesterday, but they postponed it following a meeting with Kenneth's father, his grandfather, and his lawyer. So that's very unusual, and we're taking that to be a very good sign. You know, almost all of the Texas papers have run editorials calling for clemency, basically, and saying this is sort of an outrage. And Rick Perry, I believe, is under, you know, quite a bit of public pressure. So even though the odds are against us when it comes to the board decision, because they've only ever recommended clemency twice, and Rick Perry has never granted clemency, in this case, you know, there's quite a bit of public scrutiny, and also with these very high-profile people, you know, Jimmy Carter, Desmond Tutu, that's hugely significant. So so we'll know by 1 p.m. The decision of the board, and in Texas, they're going to have a press conference at 5. And then, as you mentioned, also this cert petition that's been filed by Keith Hampton, Kenneth's lawyer, that before the Supreme Court, basically asks them to sort of re-examine the multiple sort of series of decisions by the lower courts that were mishandled, basically, and sort of pull rank and restore their original jurisdiction in the case, and which actually the Supreme Court has done in a couple of cases in this past year. Just in late June, they actually blocked the execution of a man named Scott Panetti, basically on the grounds that he was mentally ill and that the case shouldn't have even reached the Supreme Court. I mean, the lower courts mishandled it. So even though, you know, the board, the decision is really the one that we're hoping for, but if the board doesn't recommend clemency, the Supreme Court could intervene. And the execution last night that you mentioned, DeRoyce Mosley, the Supreme Court actually did step in at the last minute and delayed that execution for 5 hours. And ultimately, the execution did go through, but they do seem to be paying attention to Texas.
I interviewed Kenneth Foster's family earlier this month. This is his 11-year-old daughter, Nidesha Foster, talking about her father.
When somebody's a big part of your heart, like my father is, I mean, my father's more than half of my heart. I mean, I love him so much. And if the state of Texas kills him just for driving a car, it's like you're killing my heart. It's like killing half of me. It's like if you execute him, you might as well execute me because of the type of things and the could have, should have known stuff. And it's just how the Texas law parties, they just really need to take the time to listen. And my dad probably would not be in the predicament that he is in if law parties would take the time to listen to us.
That's Nidesha Foster, Kenneth Foster's 11-year-old daughter. She hasn't touched him in 10 years. He went to prison when she was one. Juan?
Yes, on the Supreme Court appeal, will this be, wouldn't be a hearing, it would be a decision by one of the judges, or would it be the whole court that would have to make a decision?
I believe it's by one of the judges. That's usually how it happens. And so that could happen any time between now and right up until the last minute before the execution. So in the meantime, there's supposed to be a protest in front of the Supreme Court today, I believe in D.C. There are multiple sort of protests going on in Austin, in front of death row, in front of the death chamber as well. And if people want to sort of voice their concern or their opposition to the execution, they can still call the board. And I would recommend that you can find the number online. But if you go to freekenneth.org, you can get all the information. So that's what we're encouraging people to do in these next hours. And after that, we'll see how we proceed.
And we'll continue to follow. It will be in New Orleans tomorrow, but we'll report on the latest and the decisions. Liliana Segura, thanks for joining us. Member of the Campaign to End the Death Penalty, freelance writer, writes for Alternate and The Nation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, the second part of our interview with a renowned author and psychologist, Mary Pfeiffer, who returned her award to the APA because they did not pass a ban on moratoriums on a moratorium on psychologists participating in interrogations. Stay with us.
I don't understand how they can do you like that. Just for driving a car, they can put you to death. You might have been bad, but never committed the crime. How can they convict you for the wrong place, wrong time? I wish somebody notified the system is flunked. And people are dying because they legally fucked. Makes me sick to my stomach and it tears me in pieces. Knowing this is the system people believe in. This is not the answer. It can never get better. People can change if we help them out together. But I guess it's pretty obvious.
Kenneth Song by Welfare Poets here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We go now to the second part of Democracy Now!'s interview with renowned psychologist and author Mary Pfeiffer. She gained headlines last week when she returned her Presidential Citation Award from the American Psychological Association in protest over the group's policy on military and CIA interrogations. At its annual convention just over a week ago, the APA's Policymaking Council voted overwhelmingly to reject a measure that would have banned its members from participating in interrogations at Guantanamo Bay and other U.S. detention centers.
Mary Pfeiffer rose to national acclaim with the publication of her book Reviving Ophelia, which remained on the New York Times bestseller list for some 150 weeks. She's written a number of other books. Her latest is Writing to Change the World. I began by asking Dr. Pfeiffer why she decided to return her award from the APA.
I've been following this issue as a psychologist for a couple years, mostly on your show, Amy, but last Sunday, August 19th, APA, American Psychological Association, passed what they call Substitute Motion 3, which essentially allows psychologists to continue in their roles supervising and, in some ways, overseeing planning the interrogations at places like Guantanamo and perhaps black sites as well. I was very upset by this. I also watched your show on Monday. I'd read the Vanity Fair piece by Catherine Eben, a wonderful piece, the Jane Mayer piece in The New Yorker. And it all came together, and I just decided I really don't want our organization to go this way. I've had a very good long-term relationship with APA. I'm very proud of my profession, but I was so aware that we were making a terrible mistake, and I felt it was really a moral imperative that I act. I thought my act would be of small import, and no doubt it will be of small import, but I hope two things would happen as a result of it. One would be that American Psychological Association would once again join the other helping professions. American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association, American Nursing Association, all professions that do not permit their members to be in Guantanamo or the CIA sites. The other thing is, I realized that if psychologists weren't in those sites, they could not exist, because we give those sites legitimacy. And the only thing that allows President Bush and the CIA to have a sort of veneer over what's happening there and pretend as if they are different places than, say, the bowels of prisons in the Congo or Egypt, is that we supposedly have medical supervision. And psychologists are those medical overseers. So I think that if enough people were interested in this, if enough psychologists stood up, it wouldn't just be a matter of our organization passing a better vote, stopping our members from being involved in enhanced interrogations. It would be a matter of really having the whole structure fall. So that's very much my hope, and I'll be a small part of it. It's amazing to me, this last week, I've heard from so many people, including, of course, you, Amy, on your show, who've been following this issue very closely and working hard at it. In fact, I don't think I deserve too much glory, because I'm a really relatively latecomer to this compared to so many other people who've been in the trenches for a long time.
Dr. Pfeiffer, what do you say to those who resisted the moratorium on psychologist participation in these interrogations, saying if psychologists aren't there, they can't make it better, that psychologists who were there could protest if they see torture taking place?
Well, first of all, psychologists designed much of the torture. We were involved with the SEER project at Fort Bragg. We developed the protocols. And what our field has actually done is create, through reverse engineering, actually, of some of the earlier methods for our captured POVs, we reverse engineered them into a very rapid and heinous process by which almost anyone could be broken down and hallucinating and psychotic and, in a sense, destroying their mind within about 24 hours, 48 hours. And so we've been very, very much a part of this. If we leave, first of all, it can't happen anymore. But secondly, if we leave, what we're really saying is psychologists are not involved as interrogators. You know, this goes back, my mother was a doctor in a small town. And first of all, she was a very good person. And she was one of these people that she told me a lot of stories, and all of her stories had a strong moral crux. But she took her work very seriously. She worked very hard. And one of the things that I remember her saying was parts of the Hippocratic Oath. Here's one of them. Never do harm to someone for someone else's benefit. That's what we're claiming to do. That violates the most basic of standards for caregivers. The other thing is make your patient your highest priority. Psychologists, doctors, we are about helping people. That is our mission. And so anytime we do something else, we become something else. And it's very important to me that I am defined not by the APA's current recent behavior, not by the APA's substitute motion 3, but that I'm defined as my mother was defined, by a way of thinking about human beings that, in a sense, insists I treat all human beings as people of worth and dignity. You know, I remember one thing that happened a lot. I lived out in rural Nebraska. My mom had to do everything. I mean, she was the doctor at football games. She did all the physicals. She sat with old farmers while they were dying. But she always carried her little black doctor bag. And if we stopped along a road because there was a car wreck, we did that all the time, she and my dad, who'd been a medic in the war, would jump out and run for that accident victim. And they didn't ask that person if they had a criminal history. They didn't ask that person if they were a Republican or a Democrat or paying their taxes or had the proper identification. They took care of that person. And that's what I think is our job as psychologists, just as my mother thought it was her job as a doctor.
Dr. Mary Pfeiffer, you have worked with torture victims. Explain when you work with them, where you did, and what you learned.
Well, I've worked in two capacities. First of all, I've always been someone deeply interested in human rights. Again, I think from my mother. But I was marching in 1965 in Kansas City to desegregate. I was a long-term member of Amnesty International. I was writing, ironically, today, I was writing urgent action messages all over the world to protest the torture of specific people who were being held in facilities, sadly not unlike some of the facilities where we're holding, in quotes, enemy combatants. The other thing, though, is I've long worked with physicians for human rights. I've done asylum. I wrote a book, Middle of Everywhere, in which I immersed myself in our refugee community for about 3 years. And I've always worked with refugees in our poverty programs and so on. The other thing, though, is just as a therapist, I've spent my entire life helping traumatized people. I listen to the damage that people talk about when they've been, for example, someone whose child has been murdered. One time we worked with a policeman who'd accidentally killed someone, someone who's been raped or had a child who was sexually assaulted, someone who's been abandoned by their long-term mate. I understand trauma very well. And two things I know about torture victims, Amy. One is many of them are innocent of any wrongdoing. They were tortured for purely political reasons. The other thing is there is always lasting harm. There's always lasting harm. I could tell you stories of specific people if we had the time, but what I know for sure is if you have been locked up and treated as an animal, you're never the same person again. It's like you have a chronic disease like diabetes or schizophrenia or Parkinson's. You're forever compromised. Your mind indeed has been very changed by those experiences. So I think because of my empathy and my understanding and my moral education, I was someone who was perhaps more aware of these issues than many other issues. The other thing, too, and I'm very lucky in this, is I'm not in a bad position. I don't have to make my living participating in behavior that's questionable. I've always tried to arrange my life that way, and I'm proud that I've been able to. But I'm someone who can speak on these issues and probably not be terribly hurt by it. There was a young woman in our town recently, Alex Svoboda. You did a story on her, I believe. She was badly beaten by the police in North Providence when she was protesting for some workers who weren't receiving their human rights. And I'm actually friends of her parents. They live here in Lincoln. And I saw the pictures of her, you know, sitting on the ground with her leg twisted behind her. And I know how long she's been in the hospital in the ICU, and I've heard wrenching stories from her parents. And it reminded me of this story. I don't know if you remember it, that James Baldwin told. But he'd left this country, didn't care for America. It wasn't good to blacks, and it wasn't good to gay men. And he'd moved to Paris, where he was having a great time, very respected, very admired. He never planned to come back to the States. And then the Birmingham bombing occurred. And he said he would return to the States and work for civil rights. And his line, which I remember very well, is, I will not let the civil rights movement be carried on the back of four-year-old girls. And so another influence for me in the last couple weeks, thinking about my decision, was I was thinking about Alex Svoboda, this young, idealistic girl who's trying to protect workers from working hundreds of hours a week for less than minimum wage, and about her lying in a hospital all broken up. And I was thinking, it's not fair that we ask our 20-year-olds to do all the fighting. We 60-year-olds, we people who have a little authority, we should be on the front lines with these issues. So I'm just very lucky I was in a position I could do something. There's
Dr. Mary Pfeiffer, are you encouraging other psychologists to, what are you urging other psychologists to do? I was going to say to return their awards, but you're unique, or you're one of the few who have received such a high honor.
I'm very unique because of that. Well, I think in a matter of conscience, it's better not to encourage people to do a specific action. Beyond, I think every psychologist in the country who is in accord with my thinking should do something to let APA know how deeply upset they are. Now, I actually know some things people are doing, like resigning, for example. I wouldn't recommend that. That's a very complicated question. But I think that the APA has long been a clan, the top leadership. The people on the council have been there for decades. It's a very ingrown group of people. And I think we probably need some new leadership in APA. I'm not even a member of APA at this point. I closed my office in 2000, and I allowed all my memberships to lapse. But I think for the members, it would be an excellent thing to really look not only at this specific decision, but the whole way that APA at this point is functioning. For everyone in America, I have a different agenda. And that is, at some point in this country, we all started to feel hopeless. And we all started to think that there was really nothing we could do, that we were too weak and we were too small, and we just had to lie down and let the government and the different forces that were knocking us down just roll right over us. And my own feeling about that is, the best antidote to that kind of despair is get to work. And I believe everybody in America has something important they can do that will make a difference. And so that's what I really want to see happen. I've had a lot of young people come up to me. In fact, they've had calls from all over the world by now. And everybody's saying, what you did gave me hope. And I think what every one of us does gives other people hope. And we can all do that. And we can start to regain our belief in this country as a competent country, as a decent country, as the beacon on the hill that it's been historically now for 300 years.
Mary Pfeiffer, clinical psychologist and acclaimed author. I asked her to talk about her latest book, Writing to Change the World.
You know how Pete Seeger always said about music, it isn't whether or not it's good, it's what it's good for. And I didn't come at writing as a academic or as a poet or a creative writer. I came at writing as a social activist. And I want every one of my books to have a very powerful effect in changing the culture. And so I've spent a lot of time figuring out how to do it. And the way to do it is have a deeply personal voice, my own authentic voice that comes from deep within myself. And my writing and speaking voice are virtually identical. And then the other way to do it is through stories, because you can't argue with the story. You know, people can argue with you if you stand up and say what you believe or don't believe. But if you tell them a story, and tell them a story that opens their heart, they will change. So that's what the book is about, is writing in a way that we can affect change. And I talk about this idea that the point of my kind of writing is to empower the powerless, to give voice to people who have no voice, but also to educate readers in what I call the moral imagination, and that is the ability to understand the world from other people's points of view. And that's an extremely big problem in America right now, is people don't have much moral imagination. So that when they talk about, say, illegal aliens, they don't have a story, they don't have a face, they don't have a picture of a real person. They have almost no empathy with the person they're talking about. I remember when Sensenbrenner was talking about gaming the asylum system and how we had to go after those terrorists gaming the asylum system. At that point, I just happened to have been back to Bellevue in New York City to visit their unit for victims of torture. The people on that unit that were seeking asylum were Buddhist monks from Tibet. And I just thought, man, Sensenbrenner hasn't been here. You know, he hasn't been to Center for Victims of Torture in Minneapolis. And so the job of the change writer, from my point of view, is to say, I respect you as a reader, and I know if I tell you the truth, as I see it, having spent some time listening to people and asking them, you know, Simone Veil had that question, what is your experience? Asking people, what is your experience? Which I did when I wrote Middle of Everywhere, my book on refugees. I spent 3 years asking people that. And it greatly enhanced my own moral imagination to listen to all those stories. You also have a good job for enhancing your moral imagination. But that's the job of the writer, to help other people's moral imagination grow, basically.
Dr. Mary Pfeiffer, finally, can you explain what you won the APA award for, the Presidential Citation? It was given to you by the previous president of the American Psychological Association, Dr. Gerald Kutcher, who was on our program debating this issue of torture, debating against...
Yes.
Dr. Reisner, who is a psychologist who's really helped to lead the movement for a moratorium.
Right.
Kutcher
I have respect
was,
for him.
And Dr. Kutcher was debating him, was opposed to him in that view.
Right. Well, in fact, I received two presidential awards, one from Dr. Martin Seligman in 1998, and then one in 2006 from Dr. Gerald Kutcher. And ironically, the one I received from Dr. Kutcher was for my compassionate guidance of psychologists and for my work helping educate our field about refugees and immigrants. It really was for the Middle of Everywhere book. And so it's a kind of ironic at this point that I'm on a radio show, a TV show. In a sense, I feel like I'm betraying a friend. I mean, I feel like APA has been my friend, and Dr. Kutcher, when I met him, was a very kind person to me, and he'd personally written this award. He'd flown down to San Antonio to give it to me and introduce me. So it's been a very difficult decision to... I'm a total conflict avoider. I hate very much to hurt people's feelings. But I felt like, especially in view of what I was given the award for, I needed to be a compassionate guider of our field at this moment in time.
Psychologist and author Mary Pfeiffer. She returned her award to the American Psychological Association in protests of psychologists' involvement in interrogations. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org and tune in on Monday, our Labor Day special. We'll spend the hour with one of the leading poets and book publishers of the Beat Generation, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, founder of City Lights Books in San Francisco.
Starts wars. The lower classes fight it. governments lie. The voice of the government is often not the voice of the people.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti for The Hour on Monday, on the 50th anniversary of the publication of Jack Kerouac's On the Road. That does it for our broadcast. We're headed to New Orleans for the next 2 days. We'll be broadcasting from there. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hubdo Caduce, Elizabeth Press, Aramate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Carrie Mache. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!